digging in the dirt. I'm digging in the dirt.
This is Digging in the Dirt with Kevin Gallagher, where Kevin and his guests dig a little deeper into today's issues surrounding the environment, farming, gardening, and food.
My next guest on Digging in the Dirt is a Connecticut boy. He's a real rock star among farmers, I found out. Brian O'Hara is his name. He's been growing vegetables for a livelihood for about 25 years or more at Tobacco Road Farm in Lebanon, Connecticut. And I had his father-in-law, and I find out Doug Johnson was here not too long ago talking about garlic. And, you know, we want to talk to Brian because his name has come up. In a lot of my interviews, people say, oh, you should talk to Brian O'Hara. So here I am talking to Brian O'Hara. Why is it that farmers want to know what you know?
Oh, geez. Let's see. Why would they want to know what I know? I think basically it's based on a reasonable level of productivity on the farm. And so I speak to other farmers about very practical applications of techniques that we utilize that have proven to be successful under our growing conditions. So people, they especially farmers, they seek to learn from other actual existing conditions as opposed to theories and trials from universities and things. So they really appreciate the tried and true methods of other growers.
And you seem to operate from observational method. You're really looking at your crops, and you also seem to, I would call you a tweaker. I mean, you really tweak things as you're going along.
Oh, yeah. You got to stay up to date with things because things are changing dramatically in the new environment. And so you really have to pay attention these days if you're going to get a reasonable crop.
But I'm also referring to what's going on in as the vegetable or fruit is growing. You're tweaking because you want certain results.
Oh, absolutely.
So could you explain that a bit? What do you do at Tobacco Road Farm?
So we grow vegetable crops primarily, and we've been doing that for about 30 years. It is about 3 acres of vegetables that we grow. We grow year-round vegetable crops. So we do a lot of covered, protective vegetable cultivation. And it's very, very intensive. So that there's a high yield in a small area. So we do multiple successions of crops on a given piece of land. So when one crop is finished, another crop starts. And so a given piece of land will be able to grow 2, 3, 4, or even 5 crops in a given season, depending on how it's treated and which crops they are. So we're just involved in very intensive vegetable production techniques, which require a high level of attention to soil fertility details because of that intensity of the production system. So that's led us down a road of learning and working with things that can keep up that level of production on a small area.
And how many people work for you?
We try to keep it just to the family and interns. We get a lot of volunteers that are pretty much overwhelmed often because of the techniques that we utilize are so interesting to so many people. So we have apprentices and different things like that. But basically, I recommend to other growers, if they're looking at intensive vegetable production, that you've got 2 full-time people per acre of land. And so that makes, and that can be, so 2 individuals, a couple, spending all their time in vegetable production only need an acre of land, which is capable of making their living for them. So that is another reason why the techniques that we utilize are so popular, because it puts a livelihood into the hands of people with small land base. In my town of Lebanon, for instance, there's basically a 2-acre zoning that every house has to be on 2 acres. Every single family in the town of Lebanon, as long as the land is suitable for growing crops, has enough land base with their house in order to create themselves a livelihood. So, you know, that's the level of intensity you can get to with vegetable production.
Do you have a CSA as well?
We don't do a CSA. We sell down to the Willimantic Food Cooperative, which is a relatively large grocery store in the town of Willimantic. And then we go to a couple of farmers markets on the weekends, which are in Tolland on Saturday morning and Mansfield Stores on Saturday afternoon.
I get the feeling from what I hear that you have a reputation for taste and quality. I mean, your stuff looks good, tastes good. Are you charging more for it, or are you about market price? Or and by the way, it's organic, I would assume.
Yeah, we are not certified organic, but we apply no pesticides to the crop. And that would be no organic pesticides and no conventional pesticides.
Like you wouldn't use copper?
We don't use copper as a pesticide, as a fertilizer material. Copper can be incorporated into fertilization regimes, but we wouldn't use that material to kill organisms. So we market the things not as certified organic. The vegetables are marketed simply as no pesticides applied, and that does seem to be the primary concern of the customer. And so we can assure our customer base of pesticide-free nature of the crop, which goes hand in hand with the flavor and the quality of the vegetable crop. So those things, if the crop tastes very good and stores very well and looks nice level of pigmentation, coloration's good, sugar content is high, that is exactly the crop that doesn't need a pesticide anyway. So all those things go hand in hand. When the crop is really well grown, it no longer requires pesticides, and you have all of those positive quality factors going for you. So I often tell a customer that they have rate with themselves their own mechanism for determining quality simply with their taste buds. If the crop looks, tastes, and high sugar contents in fruits, those are exactly the crops that have a proper nutritional profile and probably didn't even require pesticides for their growing nature. So it's very easy for customers to identify what has less pesticides on it simply by quality indicators.
I'm not too sure because the customers are all that sophisticated, but I guess they can become.
They certainly, it is true. But if you take like simply a fruit as an easy example, sweet fruit is easy for almost any customer to identify. Vegetables get a little more finesse to them. And yes, you need to develop, your flavors to appreciate a good turnip, for instance. A fruit, with a high sugar content, pretty much is easy to identify to pretty much just about anybody.
Mm-hmm. So I was just watching you talk to a bunch of fairly sophisticated farmers, I think. And then you showed them a slide of a field with no pests on some of your leafy stuff. And they were like oohing and aahing, they were impressed. And you say it's because you've balanced your system, right? Mm-hmm. That's what you're teaching them.
Right.
That this is a very important aspect of it. Mm-hmm. You talk a lot about balance and imbalance. Could you talk to us about that?
So, exactly. That's kind of what I was, the whole gist of the talk today that I was given was on the ability of a farmer to be able to balance conditions that have become increasingly imbalanced in our present environment. There's tremendous amounts of pollution in our environment that have caused for conditions of very detrimental growth that is causing conditions of disease and insects on the crops. So the point of today's talk that I was trying to get across to growers is how to make up for the deficiencies in excesses that an altered ecological system has thrown at us over it's actually increasing in intensity over the last few decades as pollution really gets hold of our condition here.
You're talking about the whole gamut too. You're talking about glyphosate drift, the nuclear fallout from Fukushima, jets, everything.
Yeah.
And so there's a lot of stuff degrading the environment.
Exactly. And all of that impacts crop growth and leads to conditions of unvital growth if they're not managed. So you have to make up for deficiencies in order to achieve a pesticide-free crop. Because essentially what happens is if the crop is not really functioning well, farmers are often, because of economic pressures and things, farmers are often forced to use pesticides to defend a crop that nature would, of course, destroy because it is too imbalanced. And unfortunately, that enters into the food stream as an imbalanced food source that doesn't have a proper nutrient profile or vitamin profile. It's imbalanced and will not lead to health on its own. But then, on top of that, that's the crop that is loaded with a pesticide, which also has a detrimental effect on the health of the human consuming it.
Mm-hmm. So you're not using pesticides, but you also a big part of it is no-till.
Oh yeah.
When did you go no-till?
Well, no-till we started. We've been experimenting with no-till for decades at this point. But about 10 years ago, we got very serious about the experiments and really started to try to figure out different techniques to utilize without having to till the soil. And it was probably about maybe 7 years ago now, after very successful experiments in that initial period, that we switched to completely no-till on our fields, with the exception being if we're bringing a new field into production or something, we would initially plow it to bring it into a state to be prepared for vegetable production. But once we get a field into production, we no longer disturb the soil profile with tillage equipment. And that is, if there was one technique that has really improved our quality and disease and insect resistance, I would have to say it is probably no-till. I mean, at this point, with the difficulties in the environment, to add serious soil disturbance to agricultural lands, it's just too much of an intervention that causes microbial changes and nutrient imbalances that are very difficult for the farmer to alleviate through other management techniques. So if the tillage can be avoided and nature allowed to structure the soils and maintain your air and your water and your nutrients in your soil much more naturally, then we get a much better crop growth. So the no-till really is a mimic of nature. And nature is, of course, a great teacher, so you can always look to nature for ideas on how to cultivate crops. But if you look into the soil of a forest, which is essentially what we're mimicking, it is you have a surface layer of a mulch-like material, undigested organic matter in the form of leaves and sticks and such, and then underneath that is a layer of decomposed organic material, very little mineral content. Living organic material is, of course, things that are alive, carbon-containing materials. So when the leaves and other debris decompose, they form essentially a compost. And then below that is the actual mineral layer of the soil, the sands, the silts, the clays, intermingled with some organic matter. But that concept of a mulch on top, a little bit of compost underneath that mulch, and then the actual soil, that is how we would fertilize our field, which is essentially the same technique as nature.
Yeah, and I listened to you. You are way more sophisticated than anybody I ever heard about when to do certain things, add certain minerals and silica, whatever. You're really paying attention.
Right.
My hat's off to you. It's pretty. That's why people come to listen to you. But so let's talk about compost, because you're very particular about compost.
Oh, sure.
About what you make it out of, even.
Can
you explain it to everybody what we're talking about?
Okay, so compost is based on the use of organic matter, which is carbon-containing living things. Well, actually, they were living. They could potentially still be alive, but basically the decomposition of living things is what compost essentially is. And that's where organic farming gets its name. It's based on the use of organic matter as the fertilizer material, as opposed to a synthesized chemical as a fertilizer material. So in the theory coming from 100 years ago on organic matter fertilization practices is that when you simply recycle organic materials into a fertilization compost, you have a certain mineral profile that is appropriate for crop growth, because you composted things that grew well, and they have the minerals and the vitamins and the amino acids and all the things in a proper ratio, and you simply pile those up, decompose them, and return them out to agricultural land, and you have a beautiful, biologically active, minerally balanced fertilization material. And that's what organic agriculture is based on, is the use of that material, composts, to reinvigorate the soil, just as kind of the backbone, or say the stomach, of organic agriculture. But unfortunately, in the modern environment, organic materials are highly contaminated. So previously, 100 years ago, livestock were not fed antibiotics, deworming agents, endless slew of growth hormones. And so, there wasn't arsenic in the poultry feed and insecticides in the poultry feed. So manures have become highly contaminated. With the pollution getting everywhere, the acidification of the land, even raw materials from the forest are no longer at the nutrient balance that they used to have. So all of those things combined has led to what used to be a very simple procedure of simply composting materials and returning them to the land to needing a little bit more finesse in order to make up for the deficiencies of our land. So when I talk with just a general home gardener, well, what can I do without a really high level of understanding of these kinds of things? Some of the most basic ideas to get you a decent garden crop is, of course, the use of compost from as clean a sources as you can find. However, that compost, if you're not going to till your soil, does not need to be particularly well made, which is very useful. People are very daunted by compost manufacturing because they think that they have to get really nice material because they're going to till it into their soil and use it as a fertilizer material. Well, a tilled in compost, that something you put into the soil, better be really nice. But if you just put half-decomposed compost materials and mulches on a soil surface, the biology of the soil can pick and choose and straightens out what materials it wants at what rate it needs to be introduced into the soil. So a very simple approach for home gardeners would be to make a compost pile at your house of mixing whatever kind of organic materials you can keep on hand. A lot of leaf is available to a lot of people. Grass cuttings, from un-pesticide treated grasses.
Cardboard?
A little bit of cardboard can go in there. I wouldn't make a huge pile out of cardboard because there are some glues and resins and things in cardboard. Not terrible contaminants, but leaf and grass are very common in food scraps from their house. Now, in order simply to keep it from being smelly or difficult to deal with, you do want, a common mistake is to not have enough dry carbonaceous materials like leaf or wood chip around or straw.
I've been there.
Exactly. So you do want to maintain a good pile of those materials. Leaves are a very valuable material, and there's a lot of them around here. So keep a pile of leaf separate, and then you can mix your vegetable scraps in and cover them over with leaf. Keeps away flies, keeps away smells. And so you got your separate pile of leaf or straw or wood chip, or all three of those together is great. And then you throw your vegetable scraps onto your pile that you're accumulating over the course of a year and cover it over with a good pile, few inches of these leaves and things. Just keep doing that. When it comes fall, and most gardeners putting their garden to sleep for the winter, and that's a great time to collect up even more leaf and grass cuttings and things. Simply take the half-decomposed compost materials and put them onto the garden surface and then bury them under another few inches of leaf and grasses from fall cleanup. So garden's winding down. Get all that half, you know, even fresh residues from the kitchen, whatever you got, just throw it on the surface of the soil and put a few inches of mulch material over the top of it. In the spring, so two other materials that can be useful that I will now mention are a little bit of limestone. And that is because calcium and magnesium are very deficient in our soils. In the east, a lot of acid rain, and they were acidic soils to begin with. Just a little bit, a dusting over that compost
like
residue.
A 20 by 20 plot, what would you say? How much?
A 20 by 20 plot would require maybe like 5 pounds or 10 pounds. So you can buy a 50-pound bag for like $10 and then have that for 5 to 10 years. And do every year, just put out a little dusting of calcium, magnesium, limestone. And with the crop residue or the vegetable residues and then the mulch on top. The other useful material that is nice to get into the system is a source of trace elements, and that is from the ocean. So you've got a couple options. That would be to use seawater. Go to a clean spot in the ocean. We'll go down to some of the Rhode Island beaches, are pretty open and clear, and we'll bring back some seawater and dilute that 1 to 30 with regular water and water it in to either on the vegetable scraps in the fall, but also can be utilized during the growing season, a little bit of seawater mixed in with your water when you're watering, very diluted. But the seawater contains a lot of very useful trace elements that can be utilized in small amounts. Another option is simply to purchase a liquid seaweed product and utilize that either in either of those conditions as well. So very inexpensive. A bag of limestone, $10, and all your wastes from your lawn and a little seawater. And that will cover pretty much everything that, without getting into soil testings and advanced techniques, that should cover pretty much all your bases well without overdoing anything. So simply after you've done those techniques in the fall, by springtime, assuming that there's a good amount of biological activity, and usually there's enough to consume all those residues. Obviously, if there's a chunk of something that didn't decompose, a coconut hull or something, you know, you can pitch it back out of your garden. But in the spring, essentially what you've got there is a mulched over surface of freshly decomposed material that you simply, instead of tilling the soil, you can simply move some mulch aside, set your transplant into, and there's a great release of nutrients from the overwinter decomposition of materials. If you need a little wider area, you can rake the leaf aside and rake out a bed and seed into it. But there's no reason to till because there's no weed growth on it and it's freshly fertilized, and you can simply avoid tillage and you can tuck the leaf back in to mulch around your plants. And so that's just a simple recipe for home gardening.
That's great. Thank you very much for that. Sure. You're listening to the wisdom of Brian O'Hara. He's the farmer up at Tobacco Road Farm in Lebanon, Connecticut. And as you can tell, he has a lot to tell us about different things. You know, since we talked about making stuff, I understand you do foliar preparations and amendments and some plant extracts too. I mean, when the heck do you have time to do this and farm?
Yeah.
So you want to talk about that just a little bit?
Well, in terms of the time issue, the effort put into soil fertility and plant health always pays off on the other end of efficiency of harvest, yields, weed control. So if you're gonna put effort into your garden, put it into your soil, because it alleviates all the other work down the line. If your soil's functioning and really good, your crop is gonna grow big, it's gonna shade out weeds. The soil itself will resist weed growth because weeds are a response to insufficient fertility or incorrect fertility. You don't have to water these kinds of condition, these kinds of environmental, conditions, any kind of weeds that you do have to eradicate. Of course, if you had some perennial weeds, you'll be able to just reach into the soil that's so loosened and just pull the roots out. everything is sped up down the line if you put your effort in at the beginning to handle your soil fertility first. So that is the place to put your effort. Now, in terms of foliar feeding and fertilization, basically, if you want to get into fertilization practices, if that compost and mulch and things aren't enough and you need more growth even, you have a couple options. And that is, as the plant is growing, to apply nutrient materials along the side of the plant. And that's called side dressing a plant. You can use either additional compost or liquid nutrients, or like a milk can be a very effective side-dressed fertilizer as the plant is growing to give it more growth and energy for growth. So that is a time if something's not growing right, if you need bigger or better plants, you can apply materials along the side of the plant. And then for more fine tuning of the plant in order to give it a better insect or disease resistance, or maybe a small amount of nutrient, you can apply things foliar, which means to spray a liquid nutrient source out onto the leaves. So a common foliar fertilizer would be simply a diluted liquid seaweed fertilizer, a very, very, very dilute material, maybe 1 to 500 or something like that, and seawater for the trace minerals at maybe even a 1 to 50 dilution rate. Just very, very light application rate, very, very small amount of milk. When you're talking about foliar fertilization, you're talking about very, very small amounts of material, as opposed to when you're side dressing a crop, that's when you actually fertilize it. Foliar fertilization is about providing crops with minute doses of things that potentially it's missing and there's something not correct about the plant growth.
Wow. So it's like you're finessing to a high degree. Mm-hmm. So I noticed what you said about balance and imbalance. Sometimes you're taking advantage of the balance, and sometimes you want to take advantage of the imbalance.
Right.
Could you explain taking advantage of the imbalance briefly?
So I got into a little bit that where the environment has gotten severely imbalanced. So when I was talking today, I was discussing largely about how to bring things back into balance. So for instance, just as an example of that, the acid rain that falls down on us leaches out the calcium and the magnesium, say, out of the soil. So you need to be aware of these different pollution conditions which cause certain conditions in the soil. So you need to rebalance by bringing in a calcium or a magnesium source, and it would be the same with the trace elements in that case. So that is to re-achieve balance. And balance is a sturdy, vigorous, healthy growth in terms of crops. And there's a number of factors when you look at quality that quality means balance, essentially. So as I said, long storage life, good flavors, plump seeds, thick leaves, healthy roots with the soil sticking to the root, sturdy plants yet flexible enough that you can move by them without breaking them, appropriate pigmentation, all of these things are quality indicators and they indicate balance. So now sometimes when you're trying to grow crops, once you have achieved balance and you understand balance, it is within the farmer's ability or gardener's ability to guide the crop to basically a state of a slight imbalance, but it's managed imbalance, in order to achieve what you're looking for in crop production. So in other words, when you plant your pepper, you don't have to wait for nature and the conditions that are in place to tell you when that pepper is going to be ripe. It is well within you as an agriculturalist means to influence the plant in order to bring that pepper to ripeness in July instead of waiting till September or October. And so those are the kind of techniques that you get into once you're kind of more advanced into gardening and in agricultural pursuits. or you don't want your cabbage to go to a flowering state. You want it to keep swelling into a large sized head. That requires a certain fertilization that is beyond what nature would normally offer as balance for that cabbage. So you're going to artificially use your techniques to swell that cabbage head larger than nature would have provided for us. And nature's willing to work with us. Nature's flexible and loves to work with humans. And as long as you have an appropriate relationship with the natural forces, you can work with these things in order to achieve what you as your agricultural pursuits are looking for. So we get into a lot of different techniques like that.
Yes, you do. That's really, really interesting. Mm-hmm. Speaking of really interesting, talk to me a little bit about embracing scientific achievements and movement forward, and at the same time remembering about Mother Nature and the spirits.
Right. So science has moved forward tremendously in the recent decades and is, you know, making some pretty good strides forward to provide us with information. However, agriculture is not, you know, a good specimen for science. Agricultural systems are incredibly variable, diverse, and it is next to impossible to isolate factors in order to determine that X does Y under Z. Nature and agriculture just don't work like that. The objective of science is to isolate, reduce, and determine what, you know, this little mechanism does. And science tries to then build a greater world concept from all the little tidbits of information. And that is a great step forward for humans to be able to do that. I fully embrace a lot of scientific ideas and concepts, and they can be useful, but they always have to be taken in context of our agricultural conditions, which are highly variable. So you might get a good idea from science about something, but it needs to be brought into a living system. When we approach living systems, we're actually looking at Mother Nature and God's work. And so to understand the systems that God and nature lay down in front of us, the forces that are inherent to our world, is not reduced. Everything is completely interconnected. We throw out neither side. It's very important to have the whole world view of nature and God's beings and the creation, and have that view and be able to take little tidbits of information that science is offering us to gain a fuller understanding of the creation that's around us. And that is critically important in agriculture, because a reduced agriculture scientific approach has really led a lot of agriculture down some paths historically of very, very dangerous conditions. And, you know, they always realize later that, oh, that was really poisonous. Well, you know, you've really got to be able to embrace the whole and take the reduced information from science in context of the whole.
Right. But tell me about listening to nature.
So nature is constantly offering us information and desperately wants to work with us. We humans have intentionally cut ourselves off in order to try to elevate ourselves to a better understanding. And so that's why science plays such a pervasive role in human society at this point. So we're trying to bring ourselves to a greater understanding by keeping ourselves separate. However, nature is constantly giving us signals that is very important to pay attention to. On a very basic level, they're just physical symptoms. This crop needed more water, and you should be able to see that the crop needed more water. It's a physical symptom, and it's very important to pay attention to just physical symptoms of crops and growth. Those are just primary to success. And so you need to familiarize yourself with the physical signals of nature. But nature goes way beyond that. Nature is completely interconnected and communicates with itself through all these different pathways of communication, chemical signals, and information transfers. Everything is hooked together in nature. Some great examples of that is, read some research by a fellow named Callahan years ago, decades ago. Well, he determined that, you know, the antennas on insects, the moth and such, the pollinating insects, those are an additional sense that an insect has that is able to, it monitors infrared radiations. So when a honeybee does not see the flower, it does not smell the flower, it has its antennas, and the scent molecules emitted by flowers, when sun or light strikes the scent molecules, it's sending off an infrared pattern into the air. Those antennas are specifically designed to pick up the infrared radiations of scent being reflected by light. So a honeybee knows exactly where the scents in flowers are emanating from this additional sense. And so nature has antennas everywhere, on all the leaf surfaces or all the hairs, the insect antennas. And so there's two of them, which gives them distance and direction, just like radio towers. And so they're constantly have this additional sense, which relates to our hair when our hairs are actually another sensory organ, obviously, but they sense things like when somebody is looking at you from behind and the little hairs stand up in the back of your head, that is their advanced, that's the same kind of sense that an insect has in order to sense its environment. So it's just a more reduced in human condition, but they are super sensitive with these antennas. So nature is sensing everything all the time. Our brain waves are emitted in the infrared spectrum. You are walking around in a super sensitive environment, putting out all your intentions and thought patterns into this world with your brain's emissions of infrared patterns and energy that nature is completely sensitive to. Nature is not fooled ever by humans. You will never fool nature. You cannot fool it. It knows exactly your intention. And so that's where the green thumb in agriculture comes from, is that if your mind is such that you are working with nature, nature readily responds to your intentions and your through, you know.
Sure.
Yeah.
That's cool.
Yeah.
The last thing I want to talk about is that you said that amidst all the problems and negativity and all the issues we face and, you know, like it looks overwhelming at times, mm-hmm. and even if you're out in your field or you're in your office or whatever it is, right, you say it's essential to remain happy.
Yeah.
What do you mean by that?
Okay. So health and happiness are essentially really essential to our human progress as a species. So they go hand in hand. And so if we are degenerating our health, we're degenerating our happiness, and if we've degenerated our happiness, we're going to degenerate our health. So the pursuits of both our agricultural products is to feed people, to keep them in a healthy state so that they can be happy. However, we are bombarded, obviously, with all these difficulties of pollution and ecological devastation and war and famine or whatever it is. There's huge difficulties in the modern world. And it is important at this point to maintain our health and happiness amidst all these difficulties, because the only way we can make progress with each other and humanity is to be in a state of health and happiness. They go hand in hand. So the challenge, which, you know, obviously increases, is to maintain that state despite all these difficulties. And so it requires a certain spiritual, philosophical approach that understands that it goes back to what we were talking about, balancing, that everything exists essentially for a reason, and everything is interconnected. So when things are occurring to us, we have to be able to see that that is the means of our progress. The challenges that are thrown in front of us our means of meeting that challenge to bring us to a higher state of functioning, of health and happiness. So despite the difficulties that are in front of us, when you can meet those challenges, we have progressed as humans, as a species. And so you cannot give up on that condition, that state, because you have to realize that progress is to be had simply by all these difficulties. If you can come to that state of mind, you can see that difficulty is necessary for human progress.
We're going to leave it at that. I'm Kevin Gallagher. This has been Digging in the Dirt, and my guest has been Brian O'Hara, and it's he's from Tobacco Road Farm.
Thanks, Kevin.
Thank you very much.
Right.
Digging in the dirt. Digging in the dirt.
You've been listening to Digging in the Dirt with Kevin Gallagher.